Come to shove, you was conceived in love. So if the world attacks and you slide off track, remember one fact, I got your back.
Just the two of us, we can make it if we try.
Just me and you, just me and you, against the world.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 58. No reviews, just analysis. I'm Aaron Myers, and my co-host, as always, is Andrea Shockling. Up this week, two comics from September 10th, 2014, Amelia Cole number 18, The Enemy Unleashed, and Miss Marvel number 8. On the couch, we welcome Eisner-nominated artist Ibrahim Mustafa, and listen for our newest edition, A Second Opinion, in between segments. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot. So there may be spoilers ahead.
Hey, everybody. This is Jessica at Charming Red on Twitter, the mom who reads comics, with this week's second opinion. I started reading comics around late elementary, early middle school, when my brother gave me some comics. He gave me an issue of Sensational Spider-Man, and then later on he gave me a copy of X-Force number 1. So it was mostly Marvel that I read, and I also collected the trading cards heavily. The only exception was The Death of Superman when it came along, and I would buy the trade of that and just completely devour it and reread it over and over and over again. I didn't seriously start reading comics again until I became an adult and had to stop because I was about to have my first child and did not think I could afford it, and finally picked it back up again with the start of the New 52, and I've been reading more comics now than I have ever been reading in my life.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. The theme this week is a little esoteric, even for us, but bear with me. It actually makes a lot of sense. Nonverbal sidekicks and the monologuing women who love them. We're looking at two comics with strong, young female protagonists, both of whom we've discussed, but whose points of view and commentary thereof is an important part of the identity of the book. In both cases, though, that insight, which could be honestly like really tiresome if it was constant or omniscient. Instead, it's tempered by our heroines' relationships with their nonverbal companions, who serve to actually humanize the interactions with the rest of the characters. Seriously, this is going to be a good conversation, actually, about comics.
Who said that?
Well, I did, because we got to make up for last week.
All right, fine.
This week, we're introducing a second opinion to the show. Each episode, in between comic segments, you'll hear one listener answering a series of questions, sharing his or her favorite comics, creators, and more. The prompts are going to be on the website, comicstherapy.com. So if you want to leave your own response for us to use on a future show, you can call, Skype, or email. Remember to read comics responsibly, kids, and always get a second opinion.
I've read most of my comics digitally now because one of my best friends, Karen D. on Twitter, she helped me get an iPad, and so I've been reading them digitally. When I do get to buy comics, I love to go to Madness Comics in Plano, Texas. But I just sometimes, especially when there's a nice hardback that you can collect and put on display and reread over and over again, I love to have those as well.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Aaron Myers and Andrea at Andrea Shock. The show account is at Comics Therapy. All right, so what's up? What's been up?
I was going to ask you the same thing. How are you feeling?
Not good. Thanks for asking.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Should you warn the listeners that you feel like shit and you're going to take it out on me and be sort of sad and miserable, Aaron, this week?
Yeah, is that the excuse I can use every week?
No, you're actually sick. The boys are actually sick. You get half of a free pass this week.
Okay, good. Well, I plan to use it.
Okay, so you're going to be a jerk and grumbly and it's going to be awesome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I probably won't be paying attention.
Okay. So far, I mean, this isn't different.
Yeah, this should be status quo. I'm trying to be consistent, rain or shine.
So maybe when you're sick, you should actually be delightful.
Nah.
Like, overly accommodating and just like, yeah, Andrea, I totally agree.
Nope.
Huh. Okay.
That is disingenuous, and no one wants to hear that.
How about this? Are you all ready for Rose City? Because it's 2 weeks away, and that means right around the corner for you.
No, but I have most of the books pulled so far. I need to now go through them and probably take half of them out. So I've just been grabbing books that I would want to have signed, but the like my whole little storage container is pretty full right now. And realistically, I don't need to have, you know, so many things signed. So I'm trying to keep it down to like one or two per creator that I want to see.
Speaking of delightful, it's lovely to hear how you have modified your approach to this. And like, I feel that it's a newfound maturity in you, Aaron Myers, that you don't need, what did you say, more than two signed per creator?
I mean, I do. I'd like to have everything signed. It's just not practical to bring it all with me.
So it's a selfish thing that is preventing you from doing that.
It's just a practicality. Just cannot. It's
like, you don't want to lug them around. It's not that you.
Yeah, it's just not feasible, and it's really hard to unpack them when you're waiting in line and stuff. It's like, I just got to keep things streamlined as best as possible. So, so yep, got that. I have a hotel room booked, so that should hopefully work out.
Because you're going to go crazy, right? You're going to party like a rock star.
I will be done the first day probably by 6 p.m. I will be in my hotel room by 6:15. I will be tweeting by 6:17.
And?
Sleeping.
Yeah. Huh. I think that we do cons really differently, Aaron.
Yeah, I do it right. You do it wrong.
That is one way of looking at it.
Yeah, that's true. There's, it's like saying there's a right way and a wrong way, and you saying there's what, that's one way of looking at it.
Are you going to try to grab dinner with anybody and, I don't know, be social?
I mean, do I have to?
Not at all.
Yeah, so it's my day.
And then you have another one right after.
Yeah, but I need to leave by like 4 the next day. Okay. At the latest, probably.
Is this, joking aside, is this the first time that you are gone overnight away from Chrissy and the boys?
For anything fun, yeah. Like early, Luke was maybe a year old. I had to go to Seattle for a week.
Oh, you stayed overnight when you were here for Image Expo, right?
Oh, right. Yeah, that too. Okay. I kind of blocked that part out.
You didn't stay with me. I had nothing to do with the rest of your visit.
No, I know. but yes, that would be probably the first comics thing that I had stayed overnight for.
Got it.
Other than that, it was just a work training in Seattle a few years ago.
That's not fun at all.
It wasn't bad. Because, you know, I still had a rental car and I got to go into Seattle and, you know, putz around
stuff.
But you're
not very social. What did you do?
Just, I hadn't been to Seattle before, so I went, you know, to, like, the Space Needle and whatever, the music experience and sci-fi museum and stuff, you know, all that stuff in that little area there.
Cool.
Yeah, so, I did okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But that was it. Image Expo, Seattle training, and then this. I can think of. I've been back to my parents. I like, visited my parents a couple of times over the last, like, 4 years or so. So, yeah, I get out, like, once every 180 days.
Mm-hmm. This is going to be good for you, I think.
Sure.
It's going to be fun. You sound sullen and grumpy now, but that's because you're sick. You're going to be excited in 2 weeks, and we're going to take the week off of an interview to give you all of the amount of time that you need to really revel in comics awesomeness.
Sure. It's the last hurrah of the year.
For you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all that anyone really cares to hear about.
Well, 2 weeks after that, I go to New York.
All right.
Just saying.
That'll be good for you.
We can compare and contrast the way that we do cons.
But you, yeah, you're, I don't know.
Sometimes
I understand.
Like people, Aaron. I'm sorry.
Sure. You go to cons, like the con is secondary for your con.
That, I don't understand why they are mutually exclusive. I can go to be around people who love comics like I love comics. I can enjoy the comics part and the people part simultaneously.
I guess.
No. It's very, very much true.
No. This is a black or white thing, though.
Okay. Just because you don't think that there's any overlap with the way that you kind of see this and the way that I do?
Well, for you, the con is like the destination, but the people are the purpose.
That's not true. The environment and the people cannot be separated.
They can, but there's a very specific social convention to doing a con right.
Okay.
Like, you're not doing the con right.
Okay, tell me, please. How am I not doing it right?
You don't have an agenda. You're not
That's
there.
That's not true.
You're not there specifically to see a set group of people.
I have a very specific agenda. Sometimes that agenda is shared, but it is very specific. And there's a very specific group of people that I'm there to see. Like, what? Now you're just making shit up. Are you feeling okay?
Not really. Nyhart, we've already been over this. I do not feel okay. I do not feel well. The children have been sick. We haven't had sleep for 3 days, and I'm sick now.
This is going to be awesome.
Yeah, I'm not. What is going on?
Do you want to talk about comics?
I guess.
Do you want to just listen to me talk about comics?
I guess. Do you want to just talk?
Yeah.
Should I talk?
Give me an intro, and then I will tell you about the comics that I read this week.
All right, let's do that.
My favorite book right now has to be She-Hulk by Charles Soule and Javier Pulido, published by Marvel Comics. And I own every single She-Hulk title that is out there. If I don't have it physically, I have it digitally, and I just devour everything and anything that is She-Hulk. I think she's one of the most underrated characters in the Marvel Universe, and I think Charles Soule is doing a fabulous job of making her more real, showing her intelligent side and her compassionate side, and how she is all about being there for her friends no matter what, or even if she is personally going through a selfish period.
Our first book this week is Amelia Cole number 18, which is part 6 of The Enemy Unleashed. It's written by DJ Kirkbride and Adam P. Knave, with art by Nick Brokenshire. It's colored by Nick and Reese Moreno, and lettered by Rachel Deering. Amelia Cole is published digitally by Monkey Brain Comics. The first 3 print volumes are published by IDW.
I should point out that the 3rd volume isn't actually out yet.
No, but it is available for pre-order.
Absolutely. You've heard us talk about Amelia Cole before. She's the spunky protagonist of this all-ages series, and we're both big fans. And Amelia is magical. I mean, like, actually, like, really magical. And she's currently the protector of a city in a world where not everybody there has magic ability. It's sort of a mix. As opposed to the 2 other worlds that Amelia knows about, the all magic and the non-magic. Anyway, the former protector, Hector, has been serving time with the Omega Company, a band of military mages fighting magic-sucking monsters far away from home. Amelia has uncovered a conspiracy with the Magistrate and the Mysterious Council. Her friends have been captured, the magic-sucking monsters have now been unleashed upon the town, and, like, pretty much everything is falling apart. But she still has her faithful golem sidekick, Lemmy. And now that the Omega Company is back to help fight, she and Hector are finally reunited! And I'm super excited about that. I'm sure that everything is gonna be fine now.
Sure.
Not really.
Now, how spoilery do we want to get?
Well, that is a very good question. I think that for the general conversation about Amelia and her point of view and her relationship with Lemmy, we actually don't need to get super spoilery. However, I kind of want to address what happens in this issue specifically, because it is very much tied to Amelia's point of view and her relationship with Lemmy, which is probably a spoiler in and of itself.
Sure. I mean, what I like about characters like Lemmy is, and I think this goes to the heart of the conversation this week, is non-verbalizing and non-emotive sidekicks,
mm-hmm.
like anthropomorphized sidekicks like this,
mm-hmm.
are basically sponges for our own projections.
Oh yeah, totally. And what it means is that instead of just monologuing and sounding kind of pretentious and annoying, she's developing a banter with another character who can be our, like, our projected sponge, like you said.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's more revealing and less self-indulgent.
Yes, it breaks the, I don't know what you would call it, that, I guess that that omniscient monologue.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's still monologuing. Like, most of the time, she's still talking to herself. But there's enough of a balance with... I think part of it is that she's got somebody else to care about.
Mm-hmm. Even though really, He's not alive.
I know, but she's... I think it's like more... Lemmy's more of an extension of her. And, like, what she represents and her connection to magic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's why their relationship gives us more information about her. Like, it's very one-sided, obviously, because he's not really alive. But it gives her more dimension than even her interactions with, like, her friends or, you know, a lot of stuff was revealed with the way that she handled the magistrate specifically.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, she's matured since we first met her. And she's still a hothead, but, like, she cares about Lemmy and demonstrates that in a way that is really sort of subtle and lovely.
It's true. But I guess it's that externalization of her caring about herself, in a way.
Yeah, but for some reason, it's not selfish.
Sure, totally. But I think it's almost... It's a nurturing relationship,
yeah.
Even though he's not a child. He's
but
not
it's
alive.
Like a pet.
Yeah, I guess so.
Right? Like,
but he's more than that, too, because he is a weapon and a defender and a wall and a tool and everything else.
Right, but he still has more of a, like, follower role. Like, you're right, saying pet is, like, super disrespectful to how awesome Lemmy is. But I think it's hard for me not to compare him directly to Lockjaw. Who mm-hmm. we're going to talk about with Ms. Marvel, still a really powerful creature in and of himself, but serves more of a more traditional sidekick role than like any of the other characters that Amelia has been hanging out with.
Mm-hmm.
And also the same with Kamala in Ms. Marvel.
Yeah.
Like lots of supporters and lots of friends and lots of allies, but there's a more authentic kind of personal nurturing back and forth with Lemmy and Lockjaw.
Well, the nature of a sidekick too is so it's so interesting because it's not like that father-son relationship parent and you know child relationship. Mm-hmm. It's not mm-hmm. pet, you know, it's not pet owner relationship.
Yeah.
There's a symbiosis there and there's a vulnerability in having hero having a sidekick
right
inherently opens them and makes them vulnerable, and at the same time it enhances their shortcomings.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think sidekicks, like true sidekicks, are as you just define them, are very common anymore.
No,
because I think that you sort of sacrifice a lot of agency as a sidekick, and that's why like a non-verbal non-human character is actually a little bit easier to put into that role, because
yeah.
Otherwise you would be expecting that sidekick to eventually grow out of that diminutive role.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm totally fine with Lemmy not ever growing in that capacity, although we're potentially circling back into this spoiler territory because of how their relationship has developed at the end of this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to just dive in?
Sure, we can.
I actually want to address it because I have some really big questions.
Okay.
This is maybe your fourth or fifth spoiler warning. Okay. At the end of this issue, Amelia and Hector and Lemmy are split between the three worlds.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, she's completely lost that connection to this sidekick role that Lemmy has played, and he is suddenly without his person.
Yeah.
Well, like, I don't even know what the fuck that means.
Well, it's sort of symbolic, too, for him. I mean, it's not his person, it's his creator. Like, you could take the extension of, like, you know, to Lemmy, Amelia is God.
Because
he would not exist without her.
He wouldn't exist without her. Okay, so does he still exist now?
I think where we leave off, he can sustain without her having to be around.
So he is still animated and magical.
Yes.
Even though she's in a different realm.
Yep.
That's pretty hardcore, though.
Yeah, it's a good plot twist.
It sort of undermines everything that we just set up in terms of her, like, identity. Like, he has been there for her since she was first thrust into the magic and non-magic realm.
Yeah.
And so she has had now her like, physical location pulled out from under her, as well as her, like, metaphorical grounding with him. And that's crazy times. I don't know what that means in terms of, like, as a reader, our loyalty is now split. Like, I guess loyalty is the wrong word. I don't know what to expect, except that I think we're going to have to assume that Lemmy's going to rise to the occasion more than he has had, really, like, the autonomy to do so far.
Well, I mean, isn't that the interesting kind of arc of a lot of sidekicks? You know, you mentioned that just a few minutes ago, of the sidekick growing up and moving out on their own. You know, yeah. the storylines where it's Robin on his own who has to kind of step up and play the Batman role, you know, at a certain point, that are always kind of interesting.
Except Amelia is still growing. Like, Amelia doesn't have the same, like, maturity that Batman has when he is taken on this younger person that he's going to model for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she's more at that, like, Robin stage of her life.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
it's a different situation, too. He's a golem that was magically created.
Right.
It's not a 13-year-old boy. Right.
See earlier. Right. Yeah. It's pretty fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
This is a great all-ages series, and I feel like more people should be aware of it now that we are this far along with the way that these characters have developed. So, mm-hmm. Avi hasn't read this issue yet. I'm pretty excited to talk to him about the reveal at the end. When he gets to it.
Wonderful.
Yay. Anything else?
That's it for me.
Cool.
A favorite book of mine has to be Artful Daggers by Sean E. Williams and Adam P. Knave from Monkey Brain Comics. It's a digital first book, and I just absolutely love it because it is a twist on a Mark Twain story that I absolutely love, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court. It takes that story, sets it 50 years later, and there's all this intrigue involved, and there's a lot of violence and a lot of interpersonal conflicts and drama that is occurring, and the art is just absolutely fantastic and beautiful and dynamic and extremely different than anything else you will find out there today.
Our second book this week is Miss Marvel number 8, written by G. Willow Wilson and drawn by Adrian Alfona. Colors are by Ian Hearing, and lettering is by Joe Caramunga. Oh, this is by Marvel Comics.
Oh, sorry. I didn't include that. But yeah, everybody should know, given the title.
Right.
Kamala Khan has always felt different. Nerdy interests, strict parents, and now strange polymorphing powers. Despite not knowing where her new abilities came from, Kamala realized it all happened for a reason. To protect her hometown, Jersey City, and the people she loves. And she'll do it as Ms. Marvel. Too bad being a hero comes with a downside. Mysterious, creepy villains who are set on taking Kamala down. First up, the Inventor. That's the recap from this, which is part 1 of 4, a new arc after the kind of initial setup with this book. And we talked about it early on, but we now have, like, the merging of this story more formally with the Inhumanity event. Like, we knew that that's where Kamala got her powers, even though she doesn't. But at the end of last issue, we had, like, a taste of what was coming and kind of what we're talking about now with this introduction of Lockjaw. Because Wolverine chatted with Medusa, right? And
yes.
Medusa decided to keep an eye on what was going on with Kamala. So she sent her Lockjaw, which is kind of awesome.
Yeah.
So here we have another, slightly younger than Amelia, not younger female protagonist who has the process of, like, figuring out powers, learning how she's going to play the role of, like, the hero. And she's got some help in the form of a giant, awesome, magical, teleporting dog.
Yeah. He's probably not even a dog, but he looks like a dog.
You know what I mean. He's probably not actually a dog.
Right.
He's pretty great, though.
Either that or my dog cannot do anything cool.
Yeah.
Compared to him. Man. That's all right. We can't all have lockjaws.
You need, like, an upgrade so that you can also teleport, because, damn, that would be pretty convenient.
Well, Molly has never been exposed to Terrigen mists, so it's possible.
Huh. Also, though, you could get one of those, like, weird-looking, scary results.
Yeah.
Like, not everybody got convenient powers.
That's true.
I have to say, though, if you're gonna acquire a magical sidekick, one that can teleport is pretty much, like, top-of-the-line A model right there.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's pretty strong, and also apparently very intelligent.
Coupled with what Kamala can already do, like, she's a pretty awesome one-man team now.
Yeah. Good team up.
Yeah. But, okay, so let's go back and look at what we learn about their relationship, or I guess what we learn about Kamala as a result of Lockjaw showing up.
Okay, what do we learn?
I don't know. I think that she's already very empathetic and very sort of passionate about that blend of power and empathy.
Mm-hmm.
But she's, I thought, with Lockjaw, a lot more fearless than she had been previously.
Because she also feels protective?
I'm not sure if it's just because it's a giant, cute puppy.
Mm-hmm.
Or if she has gotten more confident because she's had some more experiences. But, like, if you think about the way that she had to... Because she monologues constantly, too. And mm-hmm. and it's great. It gives us a lot of insight. But she had to talk herself into doing a lot when she went to, like, the inventor's lair. And when she fought the various contraptions that the inventor had put together. She was kind of constantly giving herself pep talks.
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't have to do that when, like, the giant, huge dog appeared.
True.
I mean, he's not... He
also had a sign hung around his neck.
Right. That he likes hugs.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's
totally Which fine. Is also, I think, it was a kind of a commentary, too, like, on Islamophobia and that sort of thing.
How so?
Because it's the fear of the other, like, that there's that panel, I forget exactly what it says, but it's sort of that panel of when you open yourself up to that, you know, which you don't know or understand, some amazing things can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with this character also being from a religious and ethnic minority that is somewhat contentious in this, you know, in this country, there's a lot of depth and kind of, you know, some commentary that can be made through this comic too.
Yeah, I certainly agree that there are a lot of layers to this story, to this character, and to her, like, the many different roles that she can play to readers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that her, like, fearlessness is a response to, is it designed to kind of balance the fear?
Well, I think two things. At this point, she's more comfortable with her powers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not quite so, like, reactionary and scary. Like, she knows how to do things somewhat, you know. Mm-hmm. or she felt like she was getting the hang of them.
Right.
So it's not quite that panic, you know, mode of, like, stumbling through and getting lucky.
Sure.
And also having a sidekick, I think, will often make the hero more heroic. Because it's someone there that they have to both take care of, mm-hmm. and are teaming up with to defeat, you know, challenges.
But that's what I mean about the balance of the power and the empathy. Like, that has overcome what could have been a situation of panic. And like, I know it's not directly the same as, like, battling a monster. But even what she... Far be it from me to call Wolverine a sidekick, but, like, he was injured, so he wasn't in top form. So even what we saw her be capable of doing in the last issue, like, she has gained in confidence, like, really rapidly, and is now at a point where, like, giant awesome puppy sidekick shows up, and she's like, bring it on. I can use this, at, like, to my advantage.
Mm-hmm. But when it goes back to the type of sidekick somebody has too, like the giant puppy sidekick is, I think, instinctually for people, like having an animal sidekick, you would feel more protective of. Like
That goes back to the pet part, though. I thought that that wasn't applicable because pets don't have the same kind of...
But I think she still has that nurturing feeling for a pet, for Lockjaw, even though obviously Lockjaw is not like a dog. You know, he's pretty
fucking capable.
He's sentient, yes. he might not speak, but he's far, you know, he's intelligent.
Right.
You know, he's maybe the Inhumans pet sidekick, but in terms of...
Like Lion Cat level of...
Sure, yeah.
Sidekick, maybe? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's also the kind, they typically in comics are like the kind of characters that the other characters underestimate because they're not particularly verbal.
That's an interesting balance with Kamala, then.
Who's always talking the stream.
Well, not, yes, she is, and it's adorable, so maybe now she'll have somebody to talk to. Mm-hmm. But mostly I meant in terms of the being underestimated. Yeah. Right? Like, that's a thing that she's clearly struggling with. And so, like, she's got this sort of very physical manifestation of now growth and power because she can get bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But because she can't do that publicly, she may have gained in personal confidence, but she's still going to be underestimated. She might just handle that in a different way now.
Well, even if you want to take it further as a societal... kind of commentary, it's underestimation of females too and their capabilities.
Oh yeah, we could talk about that.
Well, do we really need to?
it is a point that can be made about both of these books, however.
Sure. Oh yeah, and I think there's parts of that that's kind of been brought up, and there's plenty to explore in both of them too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's easy, and I think it happens all the time, that women's default, I guess, judgment by society, and, like, you know, society being the male-dominated culture, that you will start out at a lower assumption level than a man would.
Or like a sidekick.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, if anything, sure, that's a good way to think of the discussion as female characters who would be, I guess, in the past... typically, the sidekick characters are the main characters. Sidekicks of the sidekick characters now.
Right.
So, yeah. But I think there is an effort to change that perception.
Oh, I think so, too. I do. But I'm curious if you think that if either of these relationships, Amelia and Lemmy or Kamala and Lockjaw, would still be as... effective if the humans were male.
I don't know. Because
I think that you just sort of stumbled on something that's really interesting that was clearly intentional just in the character development and the character point of view, but I don't mean to imply that it's like subversive.
Yeah.
But I can't think of similar like heroes and companions like this. Where the hero is not female. And I just think that's sort of an interesting
observation. Well, I think the setup and the reactions definitely would be different. Like, if you had a male teen character in a comic like this, I don't think you would have a scene where Lockjaw was walking up to her with a cute, you know, sign on him and she's squealing and hugging him around the neck.
Okay, you're making some pretty strong... gender assumptions there, but that's sort of my point, is that that's what we rely on. You've said for both of these characters that there is a nurturing that is inherent in their relationship with their nonverbal sidekicks.
Mm-hmm.
Do we just assume that that is not something that, like, a teenage or young adult male character would be capable of?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think so. I think in this is all a lot of assumptions of who was writing it. And how they were trying to write it, but...
Well, but that's what I mean by... I'm not implying that there is actually a conspiracy or some sort of bullshit agenda here. I'm just making an observation and wondering about our reliance on those gender roles. Like, it's super empowering to have Amelia and Kamala as these, like, strong hero, like, female characters, but they are still nurturing.
Yeah.
Because there's something inherent about a female character where you would expect that.
Yeah.
Maybe. Right. I don't know.
And, well, let me ask you this, though. Is that a bad thing?
No. Like, no.
Like, it's hard for me to navigate. And this goes, I don't want to get into another gender role discussion.
Oh, Aaron.
Come on. How many times have we done this? But
gosh, it's almost as if it's not a thing that's going to go away anytime soon.
Sure, but you can only circle the drain so many times. I mean, God, we've done it. But I still need some of these assumptions to rely on before I can make adjustments. And I've already talked about that.
Okay.
You know, so it's up to the story to show me the character beyond my assumptions.
Okay.
You know?
I accept that.
And sometimes those assumptions are going to fit the character.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that the character is a stereotype. It just means that there's... Right. That's just how it is.
Right. Right.
So...
And it is a personality trait that both men and women can embody. Mm-hmm. Like, the act of being nurturing is not exclusive to one or the other. I'm not backpedaling, by the way. I'm just sort of clarifying that it's not outside of the realm of acceptance that both of these young women would have that desire to nurture their little sidekick guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that doesn't bother me as an unrealistic or stereotypical parameter.
Yeah.
But it is just something that I was mulling over while I was thinking about this.
Yeah, it's just when it comes to character portrayals, I don't think we need an effort in comics to reverse and flip, you know, perceived gender stereotypes all the time in order to, like, somehow break down, you know, how society views men and women.
I think that your point a minute ago is correct, that if it is part of the story,
right,
then,
but not not intentionally, like, this is my agenda in the story, you know. Story is, I'm going to write a transgendered, you know, 70-year-old, whatever, non-powered person who is the most powerful superhero on Earth. It's like, well, that's the opposite. Okay, does that make sense in the story, or are you doing it just to do it?
I don't know. I don't necessarily disagree with having an agenda to write about characters that are not represented. I think that you decide ahead of time that that's one of the goals, and then it is part of the story that you're telling.
Right, but not as the goals. I think this, if you're coming up and you're telling a story and that's the character, like, if that's the lead character in your story, that's the character you created and came up with, and you want to tell their story, but you don't need to shoehorn non-stereotypical characters into a story where, okay, maybe it works, but the obviousness of it detracts from the storytelling.
That's just bad writing, though.
Yeah. I'm not pointing to specific...
Don't be a bad writer?
I guess so. Or don't let personal, political, societal agendas affect storytelling.
Make good choices, everyone.
Yeah, sure. Okay. I mean, I'm not even pointing to anything specifically. I'm just...
Oh, no, neither am I.
Thinking of, like, some of the discussion I see online and wondering where, you know, how far that goes and to what point it changes entertainment culture.
Mm. You know? I don't think... And this is so wildly personal opinion at this point. It's not based on a single drop of data. But I don't think that we're anywhere near the saturation point of representation of non-traditional roles and character types where we have to be concerned about that being the majority of agendas in writers.
Everywhere. Oh, I agree. I think of it more for myself. And
is there a jerk?
I guess so. It's the kind of thing where you get locked into perceptions at a certain point in life. Uh-huh. And you have to fight against them.
Okay.
You know, and you still want to enjoy things. Because you don't want to be the guy who's saying, well, you know, that's just how I grew up. So, yeah, I don't know what you kids are doing these days, but, you know, I don't want to see it.
Don't be that guy.
I'm not saying I'm going to be that guy, but I'm saying at a certain point, your brain chemistry changes or something like that, and then you have to actively work against it.
Huh.
Yeah. I mean, a year ago, I would have said I didn't think women belonged on podcasts, and look, here we are.
Oh, it's good that you circled back around with a joke, because I was getting worried.
Well, I'm glad to have you as a sidekick. I think you're doing a good job.
Well done.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of walked right into that, didn't I?
Yeah, I mean, it was a long setup, but we got there.
Yeah. Wow.
Uh-huh.
Damn. How are you feeling there, Myers?
Pretty tired, so maybe we should talk to Ibrahim.
That sounds like an excellent plan.
All right, let's do it.
I have more series and books to recommend than I could possibly ever say, so I'm just going to rapid fire shoot a lot out there. The Sixth Gun by Colin Bunn. Pretty much anything by Colin Bunn I absolutely love, adore, and devour. Sixth Gun is published by Oni. You can also read Amelia Cole from Monkey Brain Comics, which is also by Adam P. Nave and DJ Kirkbride, and it's a great magical story that's all ages and a lot of fun. And then, of course, there's anything and everything horror I just absolutely love. So the In the Dark graphic novel from editor Rachel Deering that collects a bunch of stories in an anthology, the creepy anthology books I absolutely love. And it was dangerous for Andrea and Aaron to let me throw out recommendations because I will just keep giving them all day long.
This week on The Couch, we welcome Eisner-nominated artist Ibrahim Mustafa. Ibrahim drew The Pound, Ghoul's Night Out for IDW, but you probably know him as the artist on High Crimes, digitally published by Monkey Brain Comics and out in hardcover next spring by Dark Horse Comics. Thanks for hanging out with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, yay. Yeah. Well, it's been a whirlwind summer for you guys with the Eisner nominations and the book announcement. So let's start with an update on where things stand with High Crimes and anything else you have up your sleeve for the rest of the year of 2015 or early 2015.
Well, as of right now, I'm actually doing some color work on issue 9,
mm-hmm.
and 8 is yet to be released. So we're actually getting a little bit ahead in terms of, like, yeah, trying to anyway.
<That's awesome.
laughs> I just started a new job 2 weeks ago doing working in animation. So essentially what I do is there's a company called Friends Night that handles a lot of the cartoons on Fox, specifically like the animation domination block on Sunday nights.
Mm-hmm.
So I just got a job doing like what they call special poses. So essentially we get, an animatic, which is like a storyboard that's animated basically with the voice acting tracks overlaid into it. And, it's kind of like a rough cut of the episode basically. And then we are assigned timestamps, or time codes. And then we go into that frame and basically draw whatever our assigned character is on model. For the animators.
Oh.
Okay.
So that is it's a 40-hour week gig, and I've really worked my life over the last several years to try to, you know, just I've been working like part-time in a restaurant, like so I could draw all day. But this opportunity came up and I was like, I can't pass it up because it pays very well and it's a super cool job. So that has kind of put a halt to me doing anything that is not High Crimes related. And I'm basically, because I've been doing a lot of work for DC, kind of like advertising stuff recently. And
advertising for their, like that, like ads for inside the comics or what kind of stuff?
So they had, I started off doing some Gotham stuff that didn't end up getting greenlit by Fox.
Uh-huh.
But they've kind of kept me around doing like, they have a partnership with Gatorade right now.
Mm-hmm.
It shows up in like Twitter feeds sometimes. It's like the Gatorade League of Champions or the League of Captains or something. And it's basically like team captains from football teams and stuff. And
uh-huh.
I did a bunch of soccer ones. So there's like a web comic thing online and, like some of the football player illustrations are showing up on Gatorade bottles. Like if you go pick some up at 7-Eleven and stuff.
That's fun. Is that where the picture of the check from DC Comics came from?
That was for the Gotham stuff.
Okay.
But
that was like a giant tease that you just put out there for all of us.
I was like, I made it, Mom. I did it. Like, and you know what sucks, though, is I initially did some sample pages for The Adventures of Superman. Mm-hmm. And it was pretty much a go. Like, the editor I was working with, this guy, Alex Anton, super, super nice guy. Just an amazing editor. He sent me the sample script, and he was like, yeah, I love your work. I just want to see how you handle superhero stuff, because, you know, up to this point, most of my stuff is, you know, crime or whatever. And I'm working on these pages, like, I mentioned a minute ago, my sister had back surgery. Like, I was working on these pages in the waiting room of the hospital, like, just busting my ass. And then I find out, like, as I'm about to submit them, that the book was canceled. Just like, oh, gut punch.
But these were just sample pages without a script?
No, they were with a script. It was one of the earlier stories of The Adventures of Superman that they'd released.
Okay.
Which, if anybody doesn't know or isn't familiar with, it's like a digital first Superman anthology story they were doing, which it kind of became like my new goal in comics, because I've wanted to draw Superman my entire life. That's pretty much why I got into this whole thing. And those were especially appealing because it was out of continuity. You could draw them in whatever costume you wanted and all that.
Mm-hmm. So when something like that happens, though, what's the status? Did you still submit them, or does?
Yeah, I mean, I turned them in.
Does it shut that whole thing down? Like, do they keep them on file and they can be like, oh, hey, dude, these were great. We can't. This doesn't work for this, but maybe there's something else. Or I don't know.
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I pretty much immediately started getting the Gotham stuff after that, and the Gatorade stuff. So, I think it was more or less like, you know, you sort of do the tryout pages, and the editor sees that you turn them in a timely manner, and mm-hmm. as long as he's happy with the work, he continues to hit me up for like, hey, man, I got this thing. Are you interested in it? Sort of mm-hmm. deal. So, but yeah, it's been pretty fun doing that stuff. It's a workout, because it's like, you know, quick turnaround, and it's sort of commercial mm-hmm. illustration. It's very similar. Like, you have, you know, there's a client that DC is trying to please, and, you know, so we have to make sure that, and it's a lot of likeness stuff too. So I have to make sure that everybody's likeness is consistent and on model and all that good stuff. Wow. So it's a workout.
Does that kind of stuff have to then go by the wayside because of your day job now?
Yeah, it's looking like it. I've pretty much, for the last 2 weeks, like I've been sleeping like 4 or 5 hours a night, and just like working on the day job 8 hours, and then switching over to high crimes until, you know, like 1, 2 o'clock in the morning, and then getting up at 7 and doing it over again.
Yeah, you can only do that for so long before.
Remind me again, how many more issues is High Crime scheduled to go to?
12 total, and okay. We are working on the end of 9 right now. Right. So it's going to be about 3 more issues, and then it's going to be done. It's weird, because we've been working on it for so long, you know? Right. It's going to be like sending your kid to live with its other parent or something.
Well, it's interesting how these, like, when you're talking even like Adventures of Superman or whatever it is, like, they have these multiple lives, because they live first digitally and they get their recognition that way, and then they get these print collections now, and a whole new kind of group of people discover it. So even though you might be done at 12, it's, you know, it'll have this discovery process over the next, you know, 12 months.
Yeah, I'm very excited to see what its second life is in print, because I feel like there's a good chance we've reached, you know, the majority of the people, and they're kind of like, yeah, no, it sounds really cool. I just really like the feel of a book in my hands. And it's like, all right, well, I guess I can't really begrudge that, you know.
Is the hardcover going to have all 12, or is it going to be 2 volumes?
No, it's going to be the whole dealio.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about you as an artist, because you gave us some background now about what you're doing with your day job. But something that's always struck me about the way that you present yourself is that you're self-taught. And I want to know what that means to you.
Well, I didn't go to school for any of it. And then additionally, I haven't really had any, like, mentors that sort of taught me, like, oh, hey, this is how, you know, page trim and bleed stuff works. Like, you know, when, because essentially, when you, for those who don't know, when you're drawing a comic book page, there's sort of a perimeter section that is going to be chopped off when it's printed and trimmed.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so you have to draw beyond that line to make sure that the art continues to the end of the page instead of just, you know, having like a blank white spot or something. There's also a live area that you have to keep everything within to an extent so that, you know, when it's trimmed, like word balloons don't get cut off and that sort of thing.
Right.
Photoshop, you know, that's kind of the primary program for coloring comics and doing, like, you know, any kind of digital artwork stuff. A lot of people use one called Manga Studio too, but it's very similar. And mm-hmm. You know, I pretty much had to teach myself how to do that. There's a book that DC put out that Mark Chiarello wrote, who's the art director over at DC, called like the DC Comics Guide to Coloring Comics or Comic Book Pages or something like that. And that was a big help. But, you know, it's been a lot of, like, at least the technical stuff, a lot of YouTube video searching and reverse engineering and that sort of thing. So, you know, and I would say the only thing I've really done to teach myself, or to be taught, rather, was I took a life drawing class a few years back at the community college here. And that was a huge help just in terms of, like, learning how the human body works and how to draw it.
Right.
And that was responsible for a pretty big jump forward as far as, like, the ability to be able to draw people without reference so much.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, other than that, it's pretty much like, you know, no formal schooling or anything, just sort of finding artists that whose work I like and sort of going down the rabbit hole and doing a lot of research online and, you know, reading articles and listening to podcast interviews and watching YouTube videos.
Okay, so here you are with not a ton of direct experience in the comics industry, but obviously bringing a tremendous amount of talent to the table.
And well, thank you.
Like that self-initiative to go out and kind of supplement that natural talent with classes and things that you found online. Very smart, create your own book that's gotten some critical attention. How does that translate to you as an artist day to day? And you've talked a little bit now about how you're balancing it with your new day job, but do you get offers now from writers who want to work with you or publishers? Have you changed your, like, artist philosophy? I don't want to get too heady about this, but it seems like you've accomplished a lot very quickly, even though you guys have been working on this book for a long time.
Yeah.
But it's really grown rather fast. That has to have an impact on you. Like, right? Maybe I'm wrong.
Oh, absolutely. No, absolutely. You know, it's funny. Well, I guess to answer your question, earlier on, like when the book first started to come out, I was hit up online a lot more by different writers and stuff. And then I think when it became apparent that we had a ways to go, the emails didn't come in quite as frequently.
Right.
You know, it's my, I guess, philosophy or plan from the get-go was, you know, I had been through the portfolio review lines at Emerald City, which was really, and I guess, you know, excluding Rose City and, you know, San Diego this summer, you know, it's kind of just really the only convention I'm able to make it to because it's in the Northwest. And, you know, I spent a lot of time working on this stuff, so I can't really get away for, like, convention weekends and, you know, it's expensive and all that. But, you know, so you go through these portfolio reviews and, you know, generally the way it works is at conventions, there's a table that has a rotating, you know, special guest, somebody like Bob Schreck or Ross Ritchie from Boom Studios or, you know, different editors and whatnot. And they will, you know, you stand in line and then their window is from like 12 to noon or 12 to 2 at the table. And then Ross Ritchie comes in from 2 to 4 or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you talk to everybody and person A will say, hey, I really like how you're doing this thing here. Don't do that thing there, right? And then you get in line for the next guy, and he says, I don't like this thing here, but I really like that thing. And you're like, well, the other guy just said, you know. So it became pretty clear to me early on that, like, you know what? These people are here for one specific reason, and that's pretty much to tell you what you're doing wrong. So take that advice and run with it, but don't put a lot of stake in the idea that you're going to come in this line and wow everybody with your work, and they're going to be like, you're hired tomorrow, kid. You're drawing Batman, you know?
It's probably an important perspective to realize.
I think a lot of people, you know, they don't, a lot of people don't realize how much fucking work this is. Pardon my language, but I mean, just to give you some backstory on my journey with this, I was working in sales. I got started pretty young, like in this, at Sleep Country, which is, I think you guys probably both have that where you live.
Oh, sure.
Or Sleep Train, which is like the sister company. But it is, it's a mattress sales department store. And I kind of fell into this job, and it was like, it was very lucrative, but it was 55 plus hours a week. And I was going to school in my off days that were split days off. And I was just discovering comics and how much I loved them. And I was like, I want to do this for a living. So I got to a point where I had a friend who was working room service at a nice hotel in downtown Portland. And she told me what she made and how many hours she worked to make that. And I was like, well, shit, that sounds like a much better idea. So I switched to doing that and was working like a swing shift in the evenings, basically like 3 to 11. And so during the day I would draw. And in that time I taught myself how to color, and I did like a self-published single issue thing that I put out at one point, and like, you know, did some collaboration stuff with some other guys who were trying to come up as writers. And, you know, but the important thing was I had my ass in my seat and I was working. Mm-hmm. And I've been pretty much relentless with this whole pursuit. And then, you know, I got a gig, that thing through IDW, which was a creator-owned book that essentially the writers, it was like a co-writing team, hired me to draw. So basically they paid me out of their pockets, and then they had the deal with IDW. So it was like, once you get it done, just send it to us and we'll put it out.
Got it.
And it was the second volume. They had already done the first one with a different artist. So I did that for a while, and it certainly didn't pay the bills, but it was, you know, there was some supplemental income, which was nice. And then from there, I was sharing a studio with Joe Keating and some other local people here. And Joe knows everyone in comics, pretty much. And especially, you know, in the creator-owned scene. And I, one day I was like, hey, man, you know, I really want to do a creator-owned thing after this that is something I can really, like, immerse myself into, that I really care about. And you know, he's like, well, what kind of stuff do you want to draw? And I told him crime. So, you know, he's like, yeah, I'll keep my ear to the ground. And then like 2 weeks later, he brought Chris Sabella by the studio and was like, hey, you guys should talk. And, Chris told me the idea for High Crimes, and I was just like, what? Like, how did you come up with that? And why is nobody like already pining to draw this, you know? So he and I, you know, I finished up The Pound and then switched directly over to that. And at the time I was going to school for graphic design, which was sort of my backup plan in case comics don't work / appease my then girlfriend thing. And, you know, cause I kind of felt like the dude who was like, the band's going to make it. I just need some time, you know? And, so yeah. And then it's just been, you know, working at night and drawing all day and bringing my drawing stuff with me everywhere I go, sort of thing. And, you know, I've sacrificed a lot. That relationship didn't end up working out. And like, you know, I have some of my friends I haven't seen in months and months. And, you know, fortunately they still call me and invite me to do shit, even though I always have to tell them no. But so, yeah, I mean, it's really been a tough go, but you know, the reward is wonderful. I mean, we have a book that people have really responded well to, and you know, we were fortunate enough to get nominated for a couple Eisners, and that really helped make it all worth it. And I think, you know, people don't really realize that, like, when you do something like this, it's all or nothing. Like, I'm not saying that artists shouldn't be paid, but I've mm-hmm. been doing this book essentially for free. You know, I mean, we get a little bit of money on the back end from sales and stuff, but, you know, I think a lot of people are like, no way, man. My page rate is X amount of dollars per page. And if I don't get that, I'm not doing it. And it's like, I understand that. Like, you know, your skill is worth something and you should have, you know, sort of standards that you hold yourself to. But at the same time, like, you kind of, the way comics seem to work nowadays is like, if you can make a splash on your own, then you will get those jobs that you were standing in portfolio lines for and being turned down by, you know?
Yeah.
So can I ask a pointed question as a follow-up?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because you're an artist on a successful title with two Eisner nominations, and everybody has their own definitions of success. But but is it weird knowing, or is it disappointing knowing that you can really only do one thing at a time, whereas writers can have multiple projects and therefore multiple successes simultaneously? Is that a weird balance?
It's it can be really frustrating, you know, when you put so much time and effort into something. And I mean, like I was just saying, I've sacrificed a lot for this book and I would do it again. I mean, I'm not complaining, but, you know, when you see the reviews and they talk about how wonderful the writer is and they just don't really have the vocabulary to like say like what they like about the art. So a lot of times they just don't touch on it at all.
Sure.
Or they'll say like the art was ably handled or that sort of thing. And it's like, you have no idea. Like, you know how many fucking Google searches I've had to do for backpacks and tents and like, you know, like there's a lot that goes into the art end of things and it takes a long time. And, you know, so that, I mean, I'd be lying if I told you that didn't frustrate me quite a bit from time to time. And also the aspect of like, you know, you're as an artist, especially on a creator-owned thing like this, where you're doing, you know, pencils, inks, and a majority of the colors. We've hired Leslie Atlansky to help us, and she's doing a phenomenal job.
Right.
So she pretty much Chris flats the pages, and then she colors them, and then I go through and kind of like swap things around and put finishing touches, and maybe do some rendering here and this and that.
And then Chris, the lettering at the end?
The lettering, yeah. But, you know, it's a lot of work, and there's just no time to work on other stuff. And, you know, part of the reason that our release schedule for High Crimes has been so sporadic is because I've had to prioritize these paying gigs I get, whether, you know, like the DC stuff and, you know, a cover here and there, or there was a while where I just had to knock out a bunch of commissions because I was moving and, like, I, you know, got to pay that deposit. So yeah, you know, there's not a lot of wiggle room, unfortunately.
It does seem like artists get the short end of the stick, and not because it's an artist versus writer's situation, but it's just there are only so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
And you can't do as many different projects simultaneously as a writer can. And
absolutely.
And you're right, the vocabulary or lack of vocabulary or understanding of the medium amongst the people who talk about it is also unfortunate.
Well, and I think to that
that's
point,
like a whole separate minefield.
Well, and you know, I think it's pretty simple in that, like, a lot of people who review comics, you know, like through websites or whatever, are writers, you know? I mean, that's primarily their passion, and whether they are into writing their own comics or they just like to talk about them, writing is what they identify with. So,
right.
You know, that's naturally what they're going to gravitate towards. And they're going to, you know, they understand things like story structure and, you know, character arcs and things like that. So that's what they're going to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And the art, you know, because visual things are just sort of like a secondary to us. You know, we just kind of, I don't say we take them for granted, but you just, you know, you see stuff and that's how life works
right.
for most of us. So
I do think we take it for granted.
Yeah. And there's less attention put into it, I guess. So
I kind of have a just question. Real quick, sure. Go ahead.
Oh, just say apologies for any background noise. There's a, some kind of like a bike marathon with a finish line that is set up like outside my studio building. So
that's awesome.
Cheering and bells, that's what it is.
Just means the podcast, the interview is going really well.
Yeah.
Yay.
They're really happy.
Crowd goes wild.
Just to kind of go back to, I guess I have a question, like, where does your work ethic come from? Do you know? Like,
Yeah.
I mean, talking about this, like, it seems like you have a natural, you're just driven, you know, you got to add the jobs, you hustle. All these stories you've been telling so far are, you know, it's pushing this forward without necessarily a clear payoff too. And there, usually that work ethic comes from somewhere.
Yeah. You know, I was raised, by a single mom, and we, you know, my dad dipped pretty early on, and we just didn't really have a lot. So, you know, one, that's where the creative stuff comes from, I think. 'Cause like, you know, I couldn't just have whatever toy I wanted. So I kind of had to occupy myself. Mm-hmm. And also I've just, you know, I've had a job. I got my first job when I was, you know, 15, as soon as basically I was able to find one, you know, that would like legally hire a 15-year-old. And, I've been steadily employed ever since. And I've never really had an option. Like if I wanted something, I just had to work for it, you know? Mm-hmm. And, so that, and also having a job that I hate at this hotel, like has, you know, that serves as a constant push because like, it's easy money and you're not, you know, it's like, you don't have the because, you know, you work, you get tips and that kind of stuff working in the restaurant industry. So, you know, the amount of hours that you put in is disproportionate to the amount of money that you make, in a good way. But it's also kind of helped to serve as a constant motivator because I don't want to be there, you know?
It's not a particularly creative outlet.
Exactly. And I mean, look, you know, as far, I'm not shoveling coal or anything, so like I can't complain. And actually, I just put my 2 weeks in a couple days ago, which was like the best feeling because
but you actually know, overlapped the restaurant stuff with the new full-time
yeah and wow. I mean I was
this is
able
me
to
deleting the work-life balance question right now.
Well, you know, I was able to work it out to the, you know, because I was getting some supplemental income from art stuff, I was able to drop down to just 2 days a week at the hotel.
Got it.
So it's pretty much pulling, you know, 12-hour days in the studio, and then on Thursdays and Fridays I would go work, you know. So I basically worked both jobs that day, or those days. This last couple weeks has been ridiculous because I, you know, like I was getting to the studio by 7, working till 3, and then going to the hotel and working till 11, and it was not a good time. But
no,
fortunately, it's short lived. But,
good.
You know, it's kind of, I sort of look at it like, and I don't know if this is like a factual scientific thing, but, you know, you hear that anecdote about sharks, how if they stop swimming, they die.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of what it's become for me. Like, if I'm not constantly doing something, you know, and I've, you know, you got to find ways to maximize your work time. Like, I pretty much don't go anywhere without my drawing stuff, you know, like in a page, a high crimes page in my bag with, you know, my brush and pencils and stuff. And I just try to maximize, I mean, through family get togethers and
you're,
you know,
still doing everything
out
by hand, right?
Yeah. Just colors digitally.
Oh man. I love that.
Yeah. I don't know. I kind of look at it as like the, you know, the old samurai who makes his swords by hand sort of thing. Like I just can't really let it go.
I mean, I love a lot of digital stuff too. And you can do so much with Photoshop and Manga Studio to get similar feel to doing it by hand, but you know,
yeah,
I'm very biased and absolutely willing to admit my bias.
No, I agree. I mean, for pinups and covers and stuff, I like using digital colors quite a bit because you can just do some really cool stuff with it. And but you know, as far as like inking, and I mean, sometimes I pencil digitally too. Like I start doing layouts and then it gets kind of carried away. And then I'm like, all right, well, I'll just turn this into the penciled page. And then I print those and ink mm-hmm. over it. But there's just nothing like that brush full of ink that, you know, when it hits the page and you can kind of, the things you can do to manipulate it to sort of, you know, try to approximate real life. It's just, it's probably my favorite part of the process of the whole thing.
Cool.
This is a little bit different than I think what we normally ask. I think we got some of this, you know, some of the why comics and when you decided to do comics, you know, previous, you know, in the prior in our discussion. But I guess I'd like to ask the where do you see yourself in 5 years kind of thing, or you know, where do comics play a role in your future now that you've kind of taken this job? You know, that's going to be a full-time job. You're still going to finish up High Crimes, but what is the ideal future for you look like, and where to, and what part of that is comics?
You know, that's funny that you mentioned that, because I was just thinking about that over the last couple of days, like as I've been, you know, doing this double duty stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I listen to a lot of interviews with artists, you know, on podcasts such as this one. And, you know, you hear a lot of guys like Eric Canetti, for example. I think he's one of the finest cartoonists we have. And, you know, he works in animation because it's just like, and like Dave Johnson, who does all, you know, some of the best covers in the industry. You know, guys like that, you don't really see them doing sequentials anymore because it's a grind, you know, and they, animation just pays way better or, you know, other advertising illustration or what have you.
Yeah. I've seen that a lot. You know, yeah, people end up doing graphic, you know, graphic design, illustration, or, you know, and more animation because it pays.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, not to say that comics can't or don't pay really well either once you reach a certain level, but the amount of work that you have to do is just way, way more in comics, you know? Comics are what I want to do for sure. I have sort of come to the realization like, oh, that's why people stop doing them. Like as I've been working this job. Mm-hmm. But you know, at this point, I don't know that it's going to be a long-term thing because I'm sort of hired for like a 6-month stint. But I have a dear friend of mine, Les McLean, who was drawing The Tick for a long time. And he has a book called The Middleman that was just a pretty big Indiegogo success. And they had it turned into a TV show at one point, a few years back. He actually works for the same company, and, he's been doing it for like a year and a half. So, you know, I think the potential to do this long term is there. I'm at a point now where I have some contacts at some publishers and, you know, editors that I've, you know, become friends with and stuff. So, you know, I think I could get some work, post High Crimes, but it's a delicate balance of not wanting to take the wrong thing. Like, you know, cause we've been fortunate that High Crimes has, you know, been a success, at least critically. And, you know, I don't want to go from like what is an indie success to then doing some kind of like licensed thing that nobody really reads, you know?
Right.
So, I think the nice thing with this project or this new job is that, Chris Sabella, we've been talking about what we want to do as a follow-up, and it's something that is going to require some world building and a lot of design stuff and, you know, some work on the front end. And it would be very difficult to do that and draw a book at the same time. That's something I get a page rate for.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping what we can do is that, sort of parlay into that while I'm working on this job, and then have a significant amount ready and in the can and have it approved at a publisher. And then, you know, we can kind of hit the ground running so we don't have any delays. I got to tell you, it's been, like I said, I was in school and working and doing High Crimes when we first started. And, we were able to get, and eventually I quit the graphic design program I was in, cause I was like, this is dumb. You know, we were able to get 6 issues out in a year, which I felt pretty good about given the circumstances. And, you know, we've been plagued by just too much work and not enough time, which is why the releases have suffered so much. But, you know, I'm still working on it diligently the whole time. It's just these other things come up. So, I really want to have our next thing be something that is like clockwork. And, you know, cause I mean, bottom line, people don't know that like all this other stuff I've had to do. And, you know, Chris has been getting a lot of work too. So he's been having to prioritize paid work and not able to write High Crimes as quickly. And, you know, then there's the other life stuff. Like I had to move and my car got totaled all within like the same weekend. And like, you know, you got to take care of that shit. And there's no one to like cover your shift when you're drawing a book, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So
yeah, you can't call in sick and then collect your sick pay.
Exactly. So it's I'm sorry, I hope this isn't coming off super negative. I love
No, it's not
this.
At all. No, it really isn't. But it's a good segue to I want to play a game. I want to play a game called When Ibrahim Rules the World. It's a great game. I'll be playing it. I want to know when you rule the world, what is different about comics as an industry and as a medium? What needs
That's
to change?
That's a really good question. I think first and foremost, colorists need to get their fair shake. Coloring is so much work. I hate it. It's so much work. And, you know, I mean, people use flatters and assistants and stuff, and it's still a ton of work. I mean, Chris was flatting the book for us and, like, still going in and matching the colors to what you want. And then, I mean, it's just, there's no way around it. It just takes forever, you know? And it's kind of the thing you don't really think about until you do it. And then you're like, why is the colorist not getting top billing with everybody else? And why are they not getting royalties? And I mean, I know that a lot of colors can do multiple books a month too.
Well, their pay rate is also much lower as well.
Exactly. So they have to, yeah. You know? And I mean, you just look at somebody like Jordy Belair or like, you know, a Matt Wilson, and like these guys are, you know, responsible for 50% of the visuals of this book, you know? And I mean, colors, you know, once you start studying like color theory, you realize how much of it plays into your perception of things and why certain things are colored the way that they are just in the world, you know?
Right.
And there's a lot of deliberation behind it. And, you know, that really plays into storytelling. So I think colors definitely need to get their fair shake. And then also, you know, one of the things that I've really enjoyed about the book that we do is that it has a female lead and, you know, she's not like, we don't depict, there's no TNA shots. There's no, it has nothing to do with, you know, her body or any of that kind of stuff. She's just the main character of the book. And, you know, throughout the book, I've also made a conscious effort to, you know, like when we have our strange agents, as Chris calls them, like I try to show the non-Caucasian ones as much as possible. Like, I just think that there's, you know, an underrepresentation of women and other ethnic groups in comics. And Chris agrees, you know, if you look at Dead Letters, the lead in that is a black man. And, you know, High Crimes is a woman. And he's been writing Ghost and Captain Marvel and stuff. And
so is that something that's important to you as a creator to make comics that reflect diverse experiences and expectations in people?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, fortunately, like, you know, I'm half Egyptian, which is why my name is what it is. but you know, I was born and raised here. And so I think subconsciously I identify with, you know, a lot of different things, but I've never really felt discriminated against or like underrepresented, because I can let myself into the Caucasian male category pretty easily, I suppose. But you know, when I look at it through a different lens, like, I mean, if you just watch an hour of TV on any channel, you know, at any given prime time window, like, you're going to see all white people, you know?
Right.
So that's something that I would like to try to contribute to in my small way, you know, to change that and just kind of give other people a chance to identify with the character, you know? And that's something I hope that people do by and large throughout comics.
Yeah, it seems like that conversation is happening more. The recognition of the importance of, especially with younger or newer readers, having the ability to like physically identify with the characters, not just be enthralled with the story, but being able to recognize themselves in the books.
Yeah, absolutely.
And at least that conversation, it's going to be slow, but at least that conversation is happening more and more.
Yeah, and you know, and outside of just the actual like artistic aspects of comics, like, you know, we've seen a lot over the last year or two come to light, just of, you know, the recent video game stuff in the gamer culture and just in comics in general, like, you know, it's definitely a boys club and things are getting better, you know, and some of the best, you know, people working in the industry that we have right now are women. And I just think that, you know, the more accepting and open-minded people can be about that stuff as we move forward, like, you know, I mean, it's a trip to, like, it's almost 2015, and, like, look at the shit that still happened. Like, it's ridiculous, you know?
Right, right.
But it's also, we also have the ability now, we have tools to disseminate information in ways that we never had before, where, you know, it was easy to get away with exclusion and setting up, you know, color barriers or gender barriers because there wasn't a way for people to kind of come together, especially in an industry that's basically scattered to the wind. You know, it's not the Marvel bullpen gathering, you know, in a building in New York. It's everywhere now. So
yeah,
you at least have, I think it's, anything on the internet is a double-edged sword. You can pass along and start good movements, and you can also use it to bully and vilify, maybe not in the best ways too, but it seems like the comics industry and the comics community have by and large used it for good.
Yeah.
Which,
for like another layer of accountability or something? Is that what you mean, Aaron?
Right, yeah. At least that people can talk to each other, and people who have had similar experiences can now find each other and share those with the rest of the community, you know, their marginalization with the rest of the community and bring it to light where it's easy to ignore otherwise.
Got it.
Yeah. Well, I think also, you know, fortunately, by and large, the reaction to this kind of stuff seems to be pretty much everybody is on the same page as far as like, yeah, we need diversity. And then, you know, the people who are against it or who, you know, speak out against it or whatever are generally more and more, you know, becoming more of a fringe group of people, you know, like when that Spider-Woman cover came out recently, the Milo Manara one, like, I think by and large, everybody was like, yeah, that's not really that awesome, you know, or maybe just the people I follow on Twitter. I don't know. But, so I think things are definitely moving in a positive direction, and soon, hopefully it'll be more about developing stronger characters of diversity instead of just taking a character and making it that thing, you know, like,
well, I mean, like, I'm looking forward to when you are in charge. Like, that's my expectation. So
me too.
Well, let's wrap it up on a high note then, or a middle note, or just a different note. We usually ask for recommendations. What are you liking these days? And it sounds like you're kind of busy, so I don't know how much free time you have for comics or things that people should be checking out. But we ask for you know, some recommendations for people to be looking at things and what you're into these days, and maybe some words of wisdom to get people through the day too.
Yeah, you know, part of the funny irony of making comics is that you no longer have the time to enjoy them.
Right.
You know, there are, like, I reread recently a couple of the Adventures of Superman stories that had come out. And the one that Doc Shaner did with Ron Mars was pretty fantastic. The one that, Gabriel, the guy who does Lock and Key.
Oh, yeah.
Rodriguez.
Gabriel Rodriguez, thank you. Yeah, with B. Claymore, it was pretty fantastic. Just good, solid, classic Superman stories.
He's kind of your jam, right? I mean, like,
Superman is, yeah. Like, I have a trophy case at home filled with all of my Superman figures. And my six-year-old nephew just saw it yesterday for the first time and lost his mind. It was pretty amazing. But, Scalped is by far my favorite comics work I've ever read.
Oh, huh.
So if you haven't read Scalped, check it out, because it is amazing. If you're a fan of Breaking Bad or Justified or any of those kind of, like, you know, sort of Southwestern, Midwestern crime type of thing, like, it's fantastic. Gosh. I'm woefully behind on Saga, but of course it's amazing. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I just met Layla Del Duca, I think her name is, who draws Shudder. At Image, and Joe Keating, of course, writes it. I ran into the two of them. She just moved out here to Portland.
Right.
And she was super, super nice. So I would say read that book based on principle of her being a nice person alone.
And I think we both have read it, and we can back you up that, yes, it is something that we should read. Yes.
And also she's nice. Delightful. So, you know, Joe's fine too, but yeah.
Yeah, he's a good guy. I got mad love for Joe Keating. That's the homie right there. He looks like a young Michael Madsen, if anyone has ever thought about that.
No, but now I'm not going to be able to not think about it.
I said that to Chris the other day, and he was like, I just see Joe. I was like, all right, fair enough. What else?
Well, Chris is very enlightened. He sees everyone for who they are, you know.
Right.
Yes. Dead Letters is pretty fantastic, so definitely pick that up.
Yeah, it is.
I know I'm going to think of it that as soon as I'm sure you guys have talked about this. In fact, I'm sure you have, but The Fifth Beatle. Amazing.
You know, we actually haven't talked about it.
Did you not talk about that?
We didn't. We may have like inadvertently mentioned it just because we so rarely talk about like full length graphic novels. We both read it. We both think it's fucking gorgeous.
It's, you know, honestly, I haven't even read all of it. I just flip through the pages and drool. The artwork in that is,
it's unreal.
And have you guys read Black Sad?
Like, he paints it.
Oh, sure.
It has that quality of like hand drawn and painted that I was talking about before. That is just stunning.
It's
so unique. Yeah.
That you were saying about Black Sad.
Oh, Black Sad is another one that's just...
Yeah.
That is my personal favorite kind of noir crime.
Oh, I mean, it's so good.
Yeah, but those books take years to make, too. Like, there's such a dedication to that, and it's such a different kind of level of comics creation. It's mm-hmm. pretty crazy.
Yeah, I saw some of his original stuff at San Diego, and it was individually on a separate sheet of paper, or maybe a couple of them on one, but not in like a full comics page layout,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was pretty interesting. Mm. And just something to check out on YouTube. Have you guys heard of this Korean artist named Kim Jung-gi?
No.
No.
It's Kim and then J-U-N-G. Or was it Kim?
We'll link to it.
J-U-N-G-G-I, I think. Yeah. If you just type his name in YouTube, this guy is like, I don't even know how to describe it. He does these panoramic murals, just completely freehand with like just a brush pen. And he just goes and
bullshit.
Anatomically, everything is correct. The perspective is like wonky, like fish-eyed stuff that totally checks out. I mean, he's essentially, this guy has a photographic memory and is an amazing artist on top of that. And awesome. The two of those things, like he just, it's insane.
Cool. We'll check that out. That sounds super fun.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah.
Any last minute words of wisdom? I mean, I feel like you are inspirational without maybe you realizing that you are. You're very balanced, and it's kind of awesome to listen to how you have worked very hard to achieve what you've achieved. So I don't think we need a pithy phrase to wrap that up. It's pretty obvious from the way that you've described how you've worked in your life.
Well, thank you. And that was such an opportune time for me to have my feed of your thing cut out so I could make you say that again.
Awesome.
I appreciate it. And again, I hope I didn't come off as like a Debbie Downer or something. Like I do this because I love it, and I can't see myself doing anything else. You know, I think the most important thing I tell everyone is like, you know, people who are like asking me about getting into comics and art and stuff like that, like, just do the work, you know? I mean, in the end of the day, like, that's, if you're not doing it, somebody else is, and they're going to get the job that you want, and, you know, you're not going to make it by talking about it, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you again to Ibrahim Mustafa for joining us on the couch this week. And thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Show notes including the link to the YouTube artist that Ibrahim mentioned, and other details are going to be up on our site as always, comicstherapy.com. We will see you next week.
Well, Alibaba had them 40 thieves. Sherazade had 1,000 tails. But master, you in luck, cause up your sleeves, you got a brand of magic never fails. You got some power in your corner now. Some heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch, pizzazz, jabu and house. All you gotta do is rub that lamp. And I'll say, Mr. Lanza, what will your pleasure be? Let me take your order, jot it down. You ain't never had a friend like me. Life is your restaurant, and I'm your maitre d'. Come on, whisper what it is you want. You ain't never had a friend like me. Yes, sir, we pride ourselves on service. You're the boss, the king, the Shah. Say what you wish, it's yours, true dish. About a little more baklava. Have some of column A, try all of column B. I'm in the mood to help you, dude. You ain't never had a friend like me.
Just want to give a quick shout out to my besties of the Comic Hangout. We have a video podcast, so I want to give a shout out to VA Gentle Nerd on Twitter, and of course, Karen D_ on Twitter. I love you gals. Thank you so much.